today on Against the Grain, we are bombarded with news reports about medicine and health, about epidemics and drug trials and how to get and stay healthy. What do those news stories say about race, and what don't they say, and why is that politically important? I'm CS. UC Berkeley anthropologist Charles Briggs has co-authored a book about what health news does and how it's created. He joins us coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Health-related news stories are everywhere. Broadcast and print media are filled with reports about new drugs and disease treatments and genetic factors, not to mention dietary guidelines, epidemics, developments in biotech. I could go on and on. A portion of this news coverage invokes race and ethnicity in ways that, according to my guest today, at times propagates stereotypes and broad-brush generalizations that stigmatize and sometimes endanger people of color and immigrants. According to a new book by Charles Briggs and Daniel Hallin, journalists generally project a post-racial view of health, one that constructs whiteness as an aspirational state of well-being, while people of color are portrayed, far too often, as deficient, as imprisoned by culture, and therefore to be blamed for their own health problems. Charles Briggs is an anthropology professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's co-author with Daniel Hallin of the book Making Health Public: How News Coverage is Remaking Media, Medicine, and Contemporary Life. The book, I should make clear, offers three case studies. One is about race, and the other two address media coverage of epidemics and news reporting on pharma and biotech. When Charles Briggs joined me in studio, I pointed to one of the book's main arguments, that health knowledge is co-produced, and I asked him what that meant.
It's not just journalists who make news about health. News about health happens everywhere. It happens in laboratories. It happens in clinics and hospitals. It happens in public health offices. We got interested, on the one hand, when we began looking into this, at why there was so much health news, why it was proliferating in newspapers, radio, television, internet, social media. Why is it all over? Why are people so interested in this? Why, as other news beats, many of them have sort of collapsed or downsized? You know, health news just seems to bash along. So we were also interested in why, if you look at clinics or hospitals or public health offices in the United States, why do you find a lot of people trained as journalists who are working there? And they're collaborating with folks in not just taking medical knowledge and turning it into public information, but they're working, say, with a public health campaign from the very beginning to shape what it is that people think might constitute the knowledge that publics need to know about health. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, my greatest interview, I think, was with a consultant, a media consultant for pharmaceutical and biotech companies. And I said, well, how do you help your clients get into the news? And he looked at me like I was the stupidest human being that he had ever seen. He said, get into the news? I start with scientists to create a disease. And then we work on identifying a molecule. I help them shape the fundamental research. I'm fundamentally involved in the making of the clinical trials and their organization. I help choose the writer who will put an article on this in medical journals and make contact with the editors of the medical journals. We start getting the scientist to know some of the leading biotech and pharmaceutical journalists years before. And then at the very end, we might be interested in having some news coverage, say when there's FDA, that is Food and Drug Administration approval, or when something seems to require coverage. So now you've got scientists, you've got clinicians, you've got marketers, you've got journalists, and you also have people like us, patients, lay people in the street, all involved in making these stories about health. And that's where we figured that it was sort of like the logic of medicine and the logic of journalism, which are different, coming together in the making of each story. Here you have these different institutions, media and medical. You have these different professionals, some trained as doctors or as public health specialists, some trained as journalists. How are they working together? That became what we looked at under the term, which comes from science technology studies, co-production.
So it's not then you have the doctors, you have the researchers, and they're doing something, and then if we just take the news media, for example, because you focus a lot on health news and health reporting in this book, it's not just as if the journalists somehow are dispassionately taking that information and just conveying it out to the public, to the consuming public, in a way that, you know, establishes a direct relationship between the researcher and the public?
We found a couple of common sense models that people use, and I mean scholars, lay people, medical practitioners, to think about health news. So the idea is there's knowledge. Knowledge is made in laboratories. It's made in clinics. It's made by doctors, health professionals. So that's the production side. Then there's this circulation side, which is what we're doing here, where all of a sudden you've got journalists or health communicators or your physician helping to translate knowledge from a medical journal into something that you as the patient can understand. Then you've got the reception side. That's us. We're often pictured as people who are sort of ignorant vessels that need a hypodermic injection of knowledge of health so that we'll have some sense as to what to do with respect to issues of disease and treatment. That's a nice, interesting, common sense model that seems to organize health knowledge that, of course, turns us into passive receivers of health knowledge. And we found that, frankly, that doesn't seem to correspond very much to the complexity of what happens in the world. It also lines up with the common view among doctors and public health officers who say, oh, the journalists, they always get it wrong. They're always dumbing it down. They just want to sell newspapers or they just want to sell advertising. And on the one hand, it overlooks the fact that the journalists are in their own office or their own laboratory helping them to make what is seen as being scientific medical knowledge from the beginning. And that they also, I mean, look at Richard Besser, former interim director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He was the guy in charge when there was the swine flu or H1N1 outbreak. Now he's ABC News's medical correspondent, one of the most important health reporters in the country, a doctor, an epidemiologist, and throughout his career, a journalist. So what's going on there? It's a little bit more complicated than just this straight linear transmission of knowledge. And one problem with this is, if you look at that model, that means that all of us are basically stupid. We don't make knowledge about health. We're lay people. We're waiting for people to tell us about our own bodies. And we are all interested in different ways of knowing about our bodies, but we all make valuable knowledge about health, each and every one of us. And unfortunately, often that knowledge is devalued. So one thing that we kind of think about in the book is, well, what would happen if you changed that model to suggest that health knowledge is made in all these different sites and to see, first of all, the image of a collaboration, a lateral exchange of knowledge, and second of all, to start with an idea of communicative justice in health, not stigmatizing people for presuming that they're out of the loop, they're ignorant, they're superstitious, but everyone is contributing different forms of knowledge in health.
Can you talk more about the justice component of it, as you just mentioned? Because, you know, you're a very political person. I've interviewed you about a very political book. It's about health, but it's also about politics, stories in the time of cholera, and it had a lot to do with racial profiling during an epidemic in Venezuela. So what is the specifically political and specifically justice-oriented message of this book or thrust of the research that went into this book?
Well, one part of it, before we get to justice, is just that we see lots of these health stories. I mean, I'll read a story in the newspaper, or I'll hear one on the radio or on television or on social media, and you focus on the content. Oh my gosh, there's a new disease, there's a new epidemic, there's a new treatment. And what we forget about is that at the same time we're learning about some new medical thing, we're also learning about whose knowledge counts, right? So, gee, this was Sloan Kettering, a leading cancer hospital. So that knowledge must be valuable. This came from a leading doctor or an epidemiologist. So those are the people whose voices count in terms of health. Now, we look often at stories which project health among racialized populations. So Latinos, Latinas, African Americans, who have been shown through the Institute of Medicine, the highest, most prestigious body that really looks at medical research in the country, and said in 2002, Latinos and African Americans systematically get worse health care after you control for socioeconomic status and type of health insurance. And one of the reasons that this is true is the stereotypes that physicians sometimes have about their own patients with respect to knowledge. How capable is this person going to be of understanding what I say? How willing will they be to be able to sort of somehow change the way they think about their body, whether it's diabetes or obesity, and make behavioral changes to do the treatment regime that I'm suggesting? And when people are seen as being failed health communicators, sometimes on the basis of racial stereotypes, which affect all of us, right? This is not in any way targeting doctors. We're all within a society where things are often arranged in terms of these racial stereotypes. So therefore, that actually affects medical outcomes. So now you can jump to health news. Here's an article that says, Latinos have higher rates of diabetes or what have you. And then what's the explanation often in this article, which will be co-produced often by a Latino doctor or nurse who will say, well, and then a racial stereotype comes up. Latinos don't trust doctors. All Latinos? What an amazing generalization, right? I mean, this is spoken by a Latino health professional. Believe in God, in God's will. Have cultural beliefs which suggest that trusting biomedicine might not be the outcome. The idea that Tuskegee, right, the experiment, quote-unquote, in Alabama from the 1930s through 1972, which left African-American men with syphilis untreated to study the natural history of the disease, that somehow, therefore, projected as having affected African-Americans to not trust doctors and therefore not being as willing to go to clinics and get health knowledge. That's an amazing generalization, which overlooks what might have happened the last time a patient went to the clinic and if they experienced discrimination. So part of the justice issue is this. What is it like if you experience discrimination on the basis of people's perception of how good you are as a health communicator, how able you are to understand a disease, to listen to a doctor when you're in the clinic? Or if you're projected as being out of the loop, not listening through health communication, through other forms to what's being said that's about medicine that might affect your health. And therefore, this perpetuates some denigrating stereotypes. That's the justice issue. None of us should face health inequalities, differential access to the quality of treatment, to the treatment itself. But also, none of us should suffer discrimination as perceived health communicators. The idea that without even knowing us as individuals, people would think that we won't understand and that our own health would be affected as a result. That's the justice element.
Charles Briggs is professor in the Department of Anthropology at UC Berkeley, and he is co-author with Daniel Hallin of the new book, Making Health Public, How News Coverage is Remaking Media, Medicine, and Contemporary Life. Daniel Hallin is a professor in the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So this book looks at a number of case studies, and you brought up race and ethnicity, and I want to stay with that and really talk in some depth about the chapter that you and Daniel devote to patterns of racial and ethnic representation in U.S. health news reporting and the consequences it has on people. What struck you about the number of health-related stories, the proportion of health-related stories in the media that bring up, that brought up race?
Race was a very interesting case here. We looked at H1N1 or swine flu and sort of how that epidemic emerged through news coverage. We looked at a lot at pharmaceutical news coverage. But race was one of the most surprising in terms of the book of the whole of the thousands and thousands of newspaper, radio, television, internet, and social media health stories that we examined. And one thing that we expected was to see that many, many stories would somehow focus upon racial differences in health. And what we found was the dominant pattern really was somehow pushing issues of race and racial inequality into the background, kind of making us seem as if we are all in a post-racial society. Now, mind you, times change, and when the book came out, this was before a lot of the recent controversies around race and policing in the United States. I don't know that many people who have the illusion that we live in a post-racial society anymore. But here, in terms of thinking about race and health, that is a very strong projection. So really, we found a relatively small number of stories that really focused on specifically African Americans or Latinos in health. Most stories seem to construct us as universal biological beings, maybe distinguished on the basis of gender or on the basis of age, but where race isn't focused upon. So part of what we're interested in is, here's this backdrop which seems to say most of the time, race doesn't matter. And even sometimes in stories, people would say, well, race shouldn't matter, but actually here's an exception and we're going to look at some disease that seems to be unequally distributed among populations within the United States. And I should say the book focuses on the United States here. Or we're looking at, even in some cases, at medical profiling, at ways in which people are treated differently based upon their racial classification. So when these stories are relatively few and far between, what happens? So we suggest that they become the figure against the background, right, of, gee, race shouldn't matter. And when it is that race gets singled out, usually it is to say that racial difference is a problem. And as we know, in many racial discourse in the United States, when a member of a racialized population is depicted as having a problem, it's an easy move to suggest that person is a problem.
So in other words, in this case, maybe if some people or many people of a certain racial population, at least according to a news report, have a health issue, a health problem, then they're seen as more of a social problem, as a community problem?
Some great research by Leo Chavez, who's of UC Irvine, and he's looked at news coverage specifically of Latino-Latina immigration. And part of his work looks at health as well. So this sense, this narrative, which has a 40-year history in the United States of some sort of, quote, invasion, unquote, of immigrants, and the idea that, therefore, immigrants will burden the U.S. healthcare system, that immigrants might bring diseases that will threaten other populations, and looking at the profound consequences of this for stereotypes and attitudes towards immigrants along these lines. So we became very interested in what are some of these projections of how it is that the idea that people who, on the basis of segregation, of having less access to jobs, housing, schools, who suffer what are often called structural inequalities. Public health scholars have now documented thoroughly the health effects of these broader inequalities. So then you have populations that may have indicators, health indicators. Say, for example, African Americans in Berkeley. It's very interesting to look at the city of Berkeley's health status report and look at the profound racial inequalities within our own city between African Americans and other populations. These are structural issues. And what can happen is then you turn this into an individual issue, project this as members of a population not paying attention to health information, health knowledge that's circulating, and therefore having different health outcomes, and the move towards stigmatization and blaming of saying, therefore, members of this population are responsible for their own health indicators is a dangerous move. It's turning structural inequalities into what seem to be personal failings or failings of entire populations to be paying attention, to be understanding health information, and multiplying stereotypes is not good for anyone.
What if it's true that, for example, a certain community, you know, I mean, can't we generalize sometimes? Can't we say that certain members of a community, let's say it happens to be a community of color, they just don't take mainstream health advice or information as seriously, or they don't tend to, you know, access that information. They don't tend to discuss it. You know, they might have certain beliefs as a culture. What's wrong with saying that, well, sometimes that is the case, that they simply haven't received and incorporated the kinds of information that the rest of us have, and that does play a role, in addition to the structural factors you talk about, which are unbelievably important, and as you write, are often not reported in the news media. What's wrong with saying, you know, this plays a role? These people, in some ways, you know, and I'm using kind of a judgmental word here, but, you know, are inadequate receivers of information that would help them in their daily lives, in their health lives.
I had an interview with a leading African American physician and health researcher, and he said, yes, we do need to think about different ways in which African Americans might get health information. Yes, we might want to provide health information in churches, in barbershops, but how do we avoid reproducing stereotypes of African Americans as not going to clinics, as not being interested in medical information? That's crucial. The power of a good narrative is frightening. So in 2002, there were a rash of stories in California about a case in Los Angeles of Ricardo Cáceres, described as a Salvadoran immigrant, who went to a faith healer, a curandera, was injected and died. This was a criminal investigation. And the article goes on to say, well, immigrants don't believe in doctors. They, and here's a vast generalization, they, and this was not just Latinos, but Asian immigrants, you know, huge populations, all somehow fit into the same rubric. Oh, they would rather go to a back room and get a faith healer's treatment rather than going to the doctor. Of course, not looking at the vast racial differences in access to health insurance within the state of California. And then it said, well, you know, therefore people believe in, and they cited the idea of culture. Now, I'm an anthropologist. Anthropologists have talked about culture for a very long period of time, but often culture gets blamed for whether or not people get access to medicine or the health outcomes. The work of Paul Farmer, one of the leading doctors and anthropologists in our country, has shown that whether or not you believe what doctors say causes a particular disease has absolutely no outcome as to whether you seek treatment or the effectiveness of that treatment. You can believe that something else, the weather, is causing the disease, and it won't affect whether or not the treatment actually works. So in this article, it went on toward the end of all of this rash of articles about this particular case that stigmatized immigrants and suggested, therefore, somehow that immigrants, this vast category, are not interested in biomedical treatment. It said, oh, by the way, the man went, he had a terrible skin rash on his legs, and it was so debilitating that he was getting to where he couldn't go to work. He had gone to four dermatologists. And the four dermatologists could not treat his rash. And when he was losing health insurance and his job, he sought complementary and alternative medicine. Now, often whites in the United States get points for what we would call medical pluralism, for going to a doctor, doing yoga, doing meditation, and maybe acupuncture, and perhaps going to another type of practitioner. But often people from racialized populations get not only stigmatized, but dismissed as being beyond the pale of medical science if they go. So the problem with that kind of story is it reproduces medical stereotypes. Now, frankly, I lost a stepmother and an aunt to cancer because they were afraid of doctors. They avoided going in and seeking medical treatment. Both white, both middle class, both had access to health care, and they didn't use it. Here you have precisely this image of someone who avoids the contact with a doctor and therefore suffers the medical consequences. There, I don't know that we would need to invoke race to be able to explain it. You know, most of these generalizations about African Americans or Latinos as health communicators have absolutely no evidence. I don't think that the same health professionals would project whether one treatment worked or not without evidence, evidence that was statistical, that was came from the Lancet or some other type of biomedical journal. But somehow you can make projections about culture and language and belief and health. So that's what we kind of try to call into question. It's not that there are no differences. It's not that one couldn't make a coherent argument. And it's also not that these sorts of debates should not occur within communities themselves. Of course they do.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Charles Briggs joins us. He's an anthropologist based at the University of California, Berkeley. His books include Stories in the Time of Cholera, Racial Profiling During a Medical Nightmare, and Tell Me Why My Children Died, Rabies, Indigenous Knowledge, and Communicative Justice, both of which he wrote with Clara Mantini Briggs. And we are talking about a new book that he co-authored with Daniel Hallin. That book is called Making Health Public: How News Coverage is Remaking Media, Medicine, and Contemporary Life. It's just out from Routledge. You and Daniel also in this book look at a notion that you see advanced and promoted by health news reporting in the U.S., and that is of a kind of ideal health citizenship. Can you talk about that and to what extent you feel like that notion has been racialized in the sense of it's been applied to some people of certain races and not others?
So we, Daniel Hallin and I, looked at news coverage of health from the 1960s through the present. Back in the 1960s, there was this linear sort of transmission model that dominated. So people who were health professionals make knowledge before the 1960s. Your doctor is the only one you should trust to give you health knowledge. Then along comes health education, as well as the news media and your personal physician, and then the layperson gets it. Now, starting with some very strange bedfellows, social movements, the women's social movement, right? Ralph Nader's emphasis upon consumer safety. Right, and really thinking about the safety of drugs and medical devices, as obviously as well as cars, and then race-based social movements fighting for equality of access to care for Latinos, for African Americans, for Native Americans, and at the same time the rise of the neoliberal movement of saying get a government off our backs. Probably your listeners might know what I'm referring to these days. The state shouldn't be providing health care. It's up to you as an individual to be able to go out and buy on the open market whatever it is that you need. Somehow these came together to produce a new common sense model of how it is that knowledge about health seems to move. And this places the patient consumer at the center, not the doctor. So you, It's your responsibility to know your risk factors and therefore to go out and find all the information you possibly can that might relate to your risk factors. You might want to go directly to the internet and find a medical journal. You might want to look at the news media. You might go to advertising. You might ask your mother. You might go to an alternative practitioner. You need to take all of this information to rationally sift through it, to assess it, and then you make your decision. So we move away from either a sort of top-down model towards placing the individual at the center. And one thing that's fascinating is that it really goes so well with what is often called neoliberalism, the idea that the market should take care of things, the state should be moving out. So what's fascinating is you see a lot of the conservative commentators say the only good role for the state in health is giving information, not health services. So here's this new model which individualizes ideas about knowledge in healthcare that says it should be self-interest, not collective action, not the sense, the humanitarian sense that we all does have a fundamental social right to health, and that only collectively can we possibly exercise those rights. The idea of justice in health. So we're interested in this move towards this more neoliberal model. Now, where race comes in here is that in general, if you look at this sort of projection of the ideal patient consumer out there finding the information that she needs that relates to her health and then making good rational decisions about what services to consume, if ordinarily race won't be mentioned in the story, but if there's a photograph in a newspaper, if you look at the footage on television or in some of the internet or social media sites, often that person will be pictured as white. Whereas ordinarily when the focus is on a racialized population, especially African Americans or Latinos, we go back to model number one, the top down, doctors know, patients don't usually know, and particularly get projected as being out of the loop.
And passive.
And passive, exactly.
Charles Briggs, anthropologist at UC Berkeley, will take a short break and speak more with him about his book, Making Health Public. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Charles Briggs teaches anthropology at UC Berkeley, and he is co-author with Daniel Hallin, who teaches communications at UC San Diego, of a new book. It's called Making Health Public, How News Coverage is Remaking Media, Medicine, and Contemporary Life. We have a link to that book, as well as to Charles's faculty page at UC Berkeley on our website, againstthegrain.org. Now, this is really an exhaustive study in the sense that, you know, you go through all these news reports, TV, radio, print, you're checking out all the messages, you're talking in many cases to some of the people, and you referred to them earlier, who are putting themselves out there as experts on the health of a certain kind of community, right? They're quoted in a lot of these news reports. I mean, they're the go-to people in many cases for journalists who want to investigate a particular issue. You didn't stop there. You went on to convene focus groups of people to see how they perceived and responded to health news, to certain kinds of health news. And I want to ask you about a focus group that was given a news piece focusing on health services available to all children. The report says that many Latino, Latina children are eligible for state programs, but their parents aren't aware of it, and so the programs can't provide these critical services to their children. How did the focus group members respond? And I take it, if I remember correctly, these are a lot of Latinos in a certain community in Southern California, correct?
Indeed. So this takes us back to the notion of co-production. Here you have Latino media professionals and health professionals. The media professionals were from Univision, the television station, and the health professionals were Latino providers within the San Diego area. And the spot on the news suggested, oh, Latino populations don't know that even if children are undocumented, they can get access to free services. And therefore, call this particular number. And I looked at this and said, well, this projects ignorance on the part of a vast number of Latinos and Latinas in San Diego County. It's an empirical claim. Is it true? So I got together, along with Clara Montini Briggs. We went to some churches. Clara was the president of a Latino Parents Association at a middle school in northern San Diego County. So we got people together, sometimes up to 40 or 50, and we showed them this news clip. And so we said, well, what do you think? And it was just amazing because, having been projected as ignorant, often the people said, well, you know, when that came out, we saw that. And so my sister went to this particular place and asked for that service, and she was refused because of this reason. And then my comadre, right, the godparent of my child, went to this place and asked for that service and was told this. And it was amazing to see how people were producing knowledge about health, how they were pooling among themselves this extremely important knowledge about health. And their conclusion was, gee, I wish these people, both the reporters and the policymakers, knew more about the services themselves. Another story that we looked at was one that was projected on Univision that was about pesticides, that projected agricultural workers as being ignorant of the pesticides that are used in the fields and some of their toxic effects upon the workers who were exposed to them, sometimes illegally, certainly to the detriment of their health. The workers, they were a whole bunch of people who worked in the fields who were in these focus groups, said, you know, I wish the journalists had spent more than a few hours in the field because we actually could have educated them about these issues. And then they gave stories about, you know, I was exposed to this pesticide. This is what happened to me. My friend here was exposed to this pesticide. That's what happened to him. This is what happened to her. So this really challenged this projection that there's a they, that Latinos think the same way, this projection of passivity and ignorance, that there is a linear transmission of knowledge. And it led us to suggest, first of all, we've got to break these stereotypes of people as failed health communicators, and develop respect for the health knowledge that is produced in so many communities. Global health inequities, the inequities in terms of the health outcomes, both within countries and between countries, they go on and on and on. And we have to think about, where can we find innovative solutions, new ideas to tackle these sorts of problems? But somehow, these kind of stereotypes almost make it seem as if the populations that experience the most acute health problems would be the last place that we would look. Those focus groups suggest to us that those might be the first places we'd look, that people have such intimate knowledge of these health inequities, that they have the power to challenge some of these stereotypes and to build coalitions, partnerships with health professionals. I mean, people who aren't doctors are often very interested in exchanging knowledge and know that medical training gives you a different take on health issues. No one's trying to say, hey, I know more than my doctor does, but let's exchange knowledge and see where that might take us.
And when you discuss in your book this fact of a lot of Latino parents going to the offices that are supposedly providing freely available services to their children and being denied services, you bring up a very telling study, or maybe it's a number of studies, that indicate that ignorance and confusion are sometimes hardwired into health services.
I should say that Hal and I are not setting ourselves up as experts on race and health, but here there are wonderful studies that look at access to services. So one of the interesting ones that was done partly through UCSF School of Medicine and Nursing looked at new programs that were available to be able to provide access to dental services for low-income, often immigrant families in the Central Valley. But they often looked at the ways in which information was sometimes not released on time, not provided to communities, that confusing information was provided to communities, or that the programs were structured in such a way that people might have to lose so many days in the field just to be able to get relatively simple dental procedures done that the deck was really stacked against families who, contra the stereotypes, wanted to know about programs, wanted to know how to be able to improve the dental health of their children, and were making enormous sacrifices to be able to get their kids to the dentist.
That's the voice of Charles Briggs. We are talking about a new book that he has co-authored with Daniel Hallin. It's just out from Routledge. It's called Making Health Public: How News Coverage is Remaking Media, Medicine, and Contemporary Life. So you were speaking earlier, Charles, about how this notion of ideal health citizenship, right, this neoliberal, you know, we're all kind of supposed to be active consumers and going out there and going through information and making informed choices, how that notion is often associated with whiteness. You and Daniel also in this book write that the deracialization, so this is how, you know, really, as you said at the beginning of the hour, there are relatively few health news reports that actually mention race. That deracialization, the non-mentioning, the lack of mention of race in these reports plays a key role in the whitening of health, in constructing whiteness as an aspirational state of well-being. Is that a little different in focus from your assertion that the notion of ideal health citizenship gets often associated with whiteness?
Well, one thing that's fascinating is that if you look at the sort of what, and we say overt deracialization, because really this is something which is hard to criticize. It's hard to pin down. It's hard to pin down unless you sit there as we did. And we, on a sampling of national news coverage of health issues, we found that of the sound bites, physicians were white 84.4% of the time. Almost always, the physicians who speak with the voice of medical authority on television were white. So somehow at the same time that race shouldn't matter with respect to health news, we find that there is a racialization of the voice of medicine. And then often the patient who is seen as suffering from diabetes, suffering from obesity. We have a very interesting story we look at, we have in the book, where you have two white blonde nutritional specialists talking about obesity on camera. And then when you look at the people that they're describing, we have these shots of folks who are cut off at the head with rather obese bodies. And you can see all of a sudden that many of them are not white. That's part of the power, of course, of the visual image, to be able to not talk about race. We shouldn't have to talk about race. But when you bring in the photographs or the visuals from many of the stories, then all of a sudden race comes in. It was fascinating if you looked at, we did a lot of work in the San Diego Union-Tribune and looked at thousands of stories. This is San Diego County. This is the county that has more Native American nations than any other county in the United States. I think 18 or 19.
Wow.
We found not one single story on Native American health. So our assessment in the end is that there's no smoking gun here. There's no simple and easy pattern. There are also stories that tackle medical racism. There are stories that tackle medical discrimination. So there are stories that seem to complicate these overall patterns, but that by and large, race works its way into stories in ways that we really want to examine and potentially challenge.
Now, you conclude this chapter on race in this book, Making Health Public, by citing the transformation of people from victim, and we've talked about that, right? You're a victim of a disease, you're seen as somebody who's suffering. Transformation of people from victim to unsanitary subject to threat. Can you elaborate on the latter two characterizations, unsanitary subject and then threat?
Well, this work partly came out of the research on the cholera epidemic in Venezuela. I had never really focused on health news, and somehow there I was interested in the way in which you have an epidemic of a disease, cholera, bacterial infection. If you have good water, potable water, then no one should get cholera. And here you had, in this area where we were working in Venezuela, 500 people who died from cholera. So we were interested in how in the news media, before there were any cases in the country, there was a collaboration between health journalists and public health professionals that told a story about cholera and suggested that there were three high-risk populations, so victims, people who themselves might have worse health conditions, and they were indigenous people, poor people, which actually at the time was 60% of the Venezuelan population, and then also vendors of food and drink in the street, the informal economy. And so the logic was, well, these people have some of the worst health conditions and have less access to sanitation. Therefore, they will become the human vectors for this disease. So all of a sudden, before there were any cases of cholera in the country, they became the threats to the health of people who are not indigenous, who are not poor, and were not part of the informal economy. So it's this logic, which we also see here, of folks suggesting that, well, with respect to some infectious diseases, here you have often immigrant workers who might be in the restaurant sector, and we get articles which suggest, well, you know, health knowledge is not well distributed among this population, and therefore we might have an outbreak of E. coli or some other disease that would come from workers within a restaurant on the basis of no empirical evidence itself, taking a racial stereotype and turning that into what could be the idea that you have people of color threatening the overall population. These stories themselves, part of the what Chavez has described as the Latino threat narrative, can reinforce many of the anti-immigrant views that are so prevalent in the United States. This becomes the biological transformation of the immigrant narrative, that now it's not demographics, but actually a threat to the population of the U.S. population, often on the basis of either erroneous information or of no information whatsoever. So this narrative, as you nicely summarized it, from victim to somebody who is not possessed of knowledge about health and about hygiene, who therefore threatens the health of other populations, again, without empirical basis.
Charles Briggs is co-author of the new book, Making Health Public, How News Coverage is Remaking Media, Medicine, and Contemporary Life. So what can you tell us about some of the other chapters? We've been focusing on the chapter about race and ethnicity in health news in this book. What else is covered and addressed in this book?
One of the dominant types of stories these days is something about a new epidemic. Of course, recently, Ebola in West Africa and then Zika, now even including with its own transmission within the United States in southern Florida, are big stories. How does something all of a sudden become an epidemic? So one thing we focused on was H1N1 or swine flu. On the 23rd, as I recall, of April in 2009, there was no epidemic. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, reported a few abnormal cases in Texas and California. No big deal. Small stories in the news media. 24 hours later, there was an epidemic of swine flu. This story that emerged in the New York Times, on the national news networks, became very powerful. It shaped public health budgets, how monies were allocated. It was a major focus of public health efforts as well as of fear within the United States. So how did this emerge so quickly? At that time, people knew very little about that disease. They all of a sudden knew in that story that there were some cases in Mexico and California, but there was a big commitment of policy and of funds with respect to this epidemic of a variety of the flu, which actually turned out to be less lethal than many seasonal flu varieties. So we were fascinated. How did you get a story that emerges so quickly and becomes so powerful? I mean, if you look at the New York Times after that, there are often 3 to 10 swine flu stories a day. It dominated the media. Ebola was very powerful. So we're very fascinated on how is it that these epidemic stories emerge? SARS, bird flu, avian flu, etc. That was one of our foci. But also pills, pharma. How is it that we have, on the one hand, a population which says that it distrusts pharmaceutical corporations, sees them as being unreliable on the take, and the other hand, believes in pills, believes in pharmaceutical treatment, and actually we're more medicated than ever before. So we're fascinated to look at the relationship between marketing, advertising, and news coverage of pharmaceutical issues. How does this emerge within the life cycle of a drug or a biotechnological device? And so then we, as I mentioned, work with scientists, clinicians. I interviewed my own physician, my dentist, as well as looking at people across the country. We also did some work in Latin America. I did some work in Singapore to think about these issues, to say, all right, well, so how is it that somehow we get these images, both negative and positive? The Vioxx controversy. Here we have a blockbuster drug that many people are taking, and we find out that it seems to be no more effective than over-the-counter medications for pain, much more expensive, and in the end seems to have elevated the risk of stroke and heart attack. And this information was known to the corporation that produced it, but was withheld from physicians and consumers. But also looking at the role of the news media, on the one hand, of producing the image of a new blockbuster drug and of giving less coverage to some of these cautionary notes about, well, what may be going wrong with this particular medication.
A lot contained in, a lot to read about in the new book, Making Health Public, How News Coverage is Remaking Media, Medicine, and Contemporary Life, authored by my guest Charles Briggs and Daniel Hallin, who is a professor in the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Charles is a professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. We have links and resources on againstthegrain.org. Charles, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, C.S. It's been a great pleasure.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.